3-8. Right, Mr. James, so we're talking about the difficulty of learning the troops to march in the meadow, but once you moved to Dunfermline, it became a lot easier, and Sergeant Stern came into his own at this point, his training methods. If you could just talk a little bit about him.
Well, the day arrived when we thankfully left Morton Hall. I think we were all pleased to get away from the fields and from the bell tents, you know. And we still hadn't formed platoons. I remember particularly because I would have been in the platoon as a signals NCO, but I wasn't. I was with Harry Stern, Sergeant Stern, in Dunfermline, where we took over this carpet factory at the bottom of the hill. Harry Stern was Delta Hearts. He was about 40. He was ex-Indian Army. He was long service. He had a wonderful soldierly bearing. He loved his booze. He had a purple face through the booze. He was a character. He was a cockney. He used to say, "I'm Harry Stern by name, and Stern by bloody name, sir." And he used to try to put it off, but sadly, didn't have any brains. I must say, didn't have any brains. He could read a map. He could read a compass. He could live like that. He had got his promotion through his ability to drill men. He was a good drill sergeant. And he was drilling his men on this road outside the carpet factory, the dead end place, no traffic. And he was giving them what for. His verbal command was really very, very loud. And it was really terrible. And you can't pull that man there. And suddenly, there were houses nearby, and a bedroom window opened. A woman pushed up half the window, and she said, "You're a bloody great buddy. You wouldn't teach my son like that. You're a bloody great buddy. I've never heard anything so awful in my life." He said, "Lady, I've got a job to do. Send your old man down." And she slammed the window. And you all expected me to. Nobody would laugh because, you know, he really was a terror. And he meant it. And at the same time, as soon as she slammed the window, he turned around and there's a dog going red in the face trying to do a poo. And he said, "Squeeze that dog's head." Oh, dear, I've never forgotten that. Harry Stern. But that was Dunfermline. So that was the time when they could hear themselves on the road, on the metallic road. Mm-hmm. And I think the battalion drill and marching greatly improved as soon as they got away from that field in Morton Hall. Mm-hmm. One of the other remembrances of Dunfermline, of course, was going on church parade in the lovely Dunfermline Abbey, where Robert the Bruce is buried there, I understand. Mm-hmm. And that was quite an experience. Every Sunday we went to church. Right opposite the Carnegie Museum. Carnegie was East Chapel of the Americans from Bella Fortune. Buggers with his millions. But the Carnegie Center is in Dunfermline opposite the Abbey. And the Abbey region is called the Glen. Beautiful place, you know, where deep falls of the earth and fir trees.
So at this stage, the battalion was being made into a, or the recruits were being fashioned into a battalion. At this stage, did you feel you'd fit it in quite well into the setup as an
NCO? Absolutely. Yeah. I remember now coming back to Dunfermline, and I said to you just now that I don't think the squads had been formed. But then it must have been formed in Dunfermline. Because another memory I've got of Dunfermline was of some of these signals, NCOs and chaps under me marching up one of the hills. And one of the NCOs married a baker's daughter in Dunfermline. And so, therefore, we were in Dunfermline eventually, building our stay in Dunfermline as a single platoon. So platoons must have been formed.
And you were either selected by Lieutenant Girling or
yes, I was. They were looking for a signal sergeant, and I think I was at the time. I thought a corporal.
Mm-hmm. When did you get your second stripe, do you think?
Yes, I got my second stripe. I think Admiral or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that I was, yes, I was full corporal, but then the time came to form the Signals Platoon. Mm-hmm. And they were looking for the Signals Sergeant. Well, there were so many Beds and Hearts, NCOs, people of Winkies, even within the Signals, who all thought that they were cut and dry for the job. Mm-hmm. And you know, they were cutting their shivers before they were hatched. And I remember particularly one particular bloke who was a real ignoramus, and he thought there was nobody better than him for the job. Mm-hmm. But I didn't expect it. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect it. But suddenly I was called forward to the commanding officer, who now was a guards colonel.
Mm-hmm.
Money.
Oh, I wouldn't have missed out to see about
that. Bernard was sent away, he disappeared, and he went to regain Abyssinia.
Yeah, but we've got Sebag Montefiore in the battalion history, Mr. Chairman.
Montefiore was effective later, but Colonel Murray came before Sebag Montefiore. Colonel Murray, with a moustache, Grenadier Guards, or one of the guards, a Guards Colonel. Colonel Murray. And Montefiore came after Colonel Murray, because Montefiore was with us at Tetford, much later. Now, Colonel Murray was with us for a very long time, but he was the Guards Colonel, tall chap, very nice, solid complexion, thin face, long nose, moustache, a real Guards officer he was, though. And he must have been sent, only came around me, from the Guards, to be, so that they were forming this new battalion, but they were not yet organized regarding the leadership of it. They had spare officers all over the place, must have done. And Wally Bernard to be the first chap who had the idea, and he started it off. And then they had a Guards officer, Colonel Murray, and after that they had Colonel Sebag Montefiore. He was a Guard man, he was. And that was his regiment, DLI. But anyway, I was told that I was going to be, they wanted to know my credentials. Did I have anything to show regarding my signals training so that the new signals officer could see whether I had anything there to teach? And I had a perfect ledger which I bought. I bought a ledger, thick ledger, and I used that as my book. And it was in perfect order, and I have copious notes with colored diagrams, red, blue, crayon pencils in those days, and wonderful drawings of all the things, all this map, and our delay table at gates, and so on. And everything was depicted as well, in drawings, as well as written about. And Lieutenant Girling was so impressed with my book. He said, "It's perfect, it's complete, it's marvelous." He said, "I'll be one of your pupils, and I'll taught from my book. And every lesson I had as a junior signaller, I put in my book at the end of the day. It was my homework."
This is from your Beds and Hearts time,
yes,
as an ability.
It was my homework. I mean, it was my book, and I was very good at art as well. And I kept that. It was clean, good writing. In the end, I had a ledger, thick, like that, complete course that I undergone. And all I had to do was expand it.
So you were selected.
I was selected as a signal sergeant.
And
acting sergeant unpaid. 3 months paid.
And this would be late 1940, would it?
That was in November 19. We moved from Dunfermline to Dalkeith. And that was in the winter. 1940.
Yeah.
I read the Catholic Catholic in November to become, as a sergeant, to become a fully trained sergeant instructor.
Yeah. Now, how long did you spend at Catterick and what did you do
three
then?
Months.
3 months at Catterick?
3 months.
Yeah.
November, December, January.
Now, Mr. James, we've looked at some photographs off the tape of you training the Signal Squad.
Okay.
Was this before you went to work? Yeah. So we'll get into that, sir, because you've been trained, you've been selected as Signal Sergeant.
Yeah.
Now, and again off the tape, you told me a story about how you had to select out of
the
recruits.
Right.
Could you just talk about that?
I was elected, so they didn't wait for my Signal Platoon, and the time had come for action to be taken, and Lieutenant Gerling and I were charged with finding the boss.
Mm.
So we had complete freedom to visit every squad.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked, because it was lettered to me, I said, we were the former specialist platoon, the number one platoon, the headquarters company called the Signals Platoon. It's a very important job. We had to learn a lot of things like Morse code and difficult things. We had to have a very receptive brain. I was looking for chaps who had the luck to go to grammar school, who would be able to absorb instruction quickly and learn the Morse code. If you couldn't learn it, I said, don't bother. I want somebody with the aptitude, with somebody who's willing as well to learn and devote their time and study. It means study. You've got to practice it right and learn it. And moreover, learn A, B, C, D, like that, the whole of the alphabet, the house, and all the other things.
Mm.
And send and receive and learn about the instruments, including number 18 radio sets. So we had to be on a technical type as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told anyway to make my choice. Any volunteers, anybody who's been to grammar school, yes, but we'll come off this. And I never did to do. And I'd ask them, this and the other. And I'd chat to them. And immediately I could sense I got a good man here. And I had more than enough, really, for my numbers. I needed about 60 to begin with, knowing that there could be dropouts and losses, hospitalizations, illnesses, transfers, and things like that. And I set up the school, Lieutenant Gerling sat in with them from day one, and I taught them all that I had in my book. With the capable assistance of and experience as well of Tom Baker, Corporal Reynolds, Jock Gray was a private, he was a private that I got the existing signalers who came from Bedford, I chose well, and we set off. There's another corporal, Lance Corporal Howell, HWE. He was the one who married the Baker's daughter in Dunkirk. He was from Dunkirk, Bradsburg.
So all the volunteers would obviously be men that had been inducted through that 6 weeks thing.
That's right, they were their basic training.
Yeah.
And they were very, very understanding and friendly and willing types who didn't have to be chased. Who didn't have to be simply persuaded, they wanted to learn it. You could tell by the attitudes in the photographs of these chaps.
Yeah.
I won their confidence, they were all smilers, they were all my friends. And I was theirs because everything worked out marvelously.
I should have asked you earlier, when you were training as a signaller with the Beds and Hearts, about your radio, training with radio. You mentioned the number 18 set.
The number 18 set, but we didn't have the number 18 sets with the Beds and Hearts.
Did you have any radio? It would just be Morse?
No, we didn't.
It was all Morse and telephone lines.
I remember particularly we had the number 18 sets. They suddenly appeared on the, you know, in the us, however, to Scotland. Mm-hmm. We had them on our backs.
Mm-hmm.
And the worst thing about them was that the battery didn't last very long.
Mm-hmm.
And you're forever, you're carrying a hell of a lot of spare batteries to put the, you know, go to there.
Mm-hmm.
But I was taught about the number 87 in Catrick.
Ah, yeah, so we'll get on. So at the time you're at Dalkeith, and yeah. When you had you know, the sequence of photos that we've looked at, that would be in Semaphore,
right.
And the whole
the
procedure with
came out of Catrick.
Yeah, yeah. And, before we move to that, Mr. James, just any more memories of characters during this period, this very early days of the battalion when you were at Dunfermline and Dalkeith, any other characters that spring to mind? Or?
Well, just one thing, of course, the one who really was a bearing of that was Harry Stern, because he happened to be at Dalkeith as well, and we were in this place called Newton House,
mm-hmm.
and he resented my seniority.
Mm-hmm.
And said, I'm the boss of Newton House, and as long as you understand that, we get on all right. But I said, I've got to interfere with you. There was no question about who was going to be the boss in this detachment.
Mm-hmm.
I had a job to do,
mm-hmm.
and I was fully engaged in that job.
Mm-hmm.
And I was my lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
and you know, mm-hmm. I didn't have any time really at that time mm-hmm. for Harry Stern,
mm-hmm.
Especially when all the signatures from Arthur to say his demeanour mm-hmm. and his childishness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the boss of Newton House.
Mm-hmm. What about your friends at this stage, and how would you fill in your time on a night? I mean, did you have enough money to go?
Well, we were in the country,
mm-hmm.
and you could see the haylicks and the haymaking.
Mm-hmm.
There was no town life at all
mm-hmm.
in Dalkeith. It was rural,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't even have any chance or time to go into Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were you well received by what locals that you saw? Were you?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yes, we were. The Scots really were very kind towards us. About mm-hmm. that woman who lived at the Benny Hill for Harry Stern.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, well received indeed,
mm-hmm.
Because I remember particularly there was a new Hogmanay.
Mm-hmm.
And at one stage there was a holiday, and we were made a big fuss of.
That'll be Christmas 1940.
Mm. I was away. It must have been about the tail end. It must have been after Catrick.
Mm.
No, it wasn't. I went from there to Catrick, and when I left Catrick, but Canada had moved from Scotland down to Thetford.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we'll get onto that later, Mr. James. Make some final points about your time at before Catrick. In terms of discipline and morale at this time, I mean, obviously, as you said earlier, a lot of your recruits were from the south, they were from the big cities and so on, and obviously at this stage there was the Blitz and so on. Do any incidents spring to mind at this stage about how you all felt about how the war was going? I mean, this is the Battle of Britain.
I think that the discipline in the battalion was good. A lot of us as NCOs were a little perturbed about the change of them. Colonels from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And you were getting used to one colonel, we'd lose him, and they would never come.
Mm-hmm.
And, we couldn't understand what was happening. But obviously, it was a battalion growing up, it was being trained, and the war office, or whoever it is, they had, there was nothing definite until we were fully trained and down in East Anglia.
Mm-hmm.
And, Colonel Stephen Mullifery.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he was the one who, that's right, he had the stunts, and he made me the signals officer, because mm-hmm. the signals officer was in Catrick.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that when we talk about.
And I like him for his confidence in me.
Yeah, your return from Catrick. So, In Scotland, I mean, you were, as a battalion, even at the stage you were being trained, you according to the battalion history, you had kind of operational commitments in the event of an invasion, and so on. In terms of the general caliber of your recruits, what would you be your I mean, obviously you pick up the cream of the crop with the signals platoon, but generally,
Suddenly, of course, we were getting more chaps from Durham, from Bransworth, this lovely place called Bransworth. I heard a lot about it, but I wish I'd seen it or been there. Arthur Pearson came from there, and lot of the chaps, and lots of the NCOs, they came. Another NCO joined us in the signals from Bransworth. He was a tall man with glasses and rosy cheeks, and he was a sudden new NCO trained signaller. He joined us. I forget his name, but I remember his arrival very well. And he naturally joined us as another corporal in the signals platoon. And he was very useful. I think, I can't remember his name, I'm trying very, it might be something like Addison or something like that. But he was a tall, boyish faced, rosy cheeked corporal with glasses from Glasgow.
Would the NCOs from the two battalion, from the two regiments, would they have started to mix at this stage? They'd be friends with each other. The older ones
They
would.
were aware of the Bedfords. And I think a lot of the Bedfords as well were aware that there was an increasing number of DLI NCOs coming all the time, and that it was getting more and more of a Bransworth trained battalion.
Was anybody trying to get back to Kempston and back to the Bedfords?
I think myself that Pearson Glover did eventually. There was a Colonel Sergeant Day, who was a Bedford Hearts chap and who had been in India and who was the secret messenger for the company. And he wanted to leave the DLI, and he got a commission in the Indian Army. And so, under our company commander, Major Sheldon Wallison, he suddenly left us as a Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire chap, secret mess. He was supposed to be a chicken. And he joined the Indian Army and was transferred. Sheldon Wallison saw me as a signal sergeant just down from Catterick. I said, "Taffy, you're doing no bloody good, lad. Forget the signalling, hand over your money bag. You're my new secret man. Get all the money."
We'll get onto that when we talk about
So
after we've talked about Catterick, yeah. Right, Mr. James. We're talking about the signals platoon, and before you actually were trained at Catterick, could you just talk a little bit about what the function of the signal platoon was?
Yes, during the time in Scotland, after Dunfermline, we moved to Dalkeith, which is quite back across the border, and we were training there as a signals platoon in the early stages of formation. There are plenty of flag drill in the open fields, and I sent you a photograph of that. We were going through the course as written in my well-written book, not missing anything. Lieutenant Colonel Lieutenant Girling was the signals officer appointed, but of course he didn't know a thing about signaling, and he said that he would sit in with the class and learn about signaling from me. And so that he was a sort of more knowledge than anybody in the class. And he was equipped with all the rest of them. And so we went down to it, and we were learning all there was to learn about signaling and practicing Morse and learning the procedure and all there is to learn with signaling. So that's what kept us busy at Dalkey.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of the actual role of the signals platoon and like the operation of the battalion,
yes.
Who would you be signalling from and who to?
Yes,
what were you
at that time we weren't really operational.
Yes, but what were you training to in action? What would be the job of the signals platoon? Would you be between the platoons and HQ or how?
When you were fully trained, as signallers, of course, they would be allotted to companies. Every company on operations would have their company office and their signaller. Two men, actually, two signallers, with a DON 5 set, that's the for Morse, and also, of course, the DON 5 set had a handset, and there was some verbal communications as well. So the companies, each company, A, B, C, D, and headquarters, had their, in their company office, had signallers with their telephone. And they were in touch with the town headquarters. There was a procedure where they had to maintain communication every second. And so, therefore, they were testing if messages were not being passed and they were very busy. They, every few minutes, used to bring up and test around the various companies to make sure that communications were live and all that sort of thing. The signal sergeant in the platoon and his NCOs would visit the companies as well. And in so doing, from wherever they were, they would also, it was all line signaling, you see, a cable, apart from later on we had another 18 set on the back of the Liverpool mobile radio, but it was mainly line signaling. And so they would, if they were walking from one country to another, they would pick up the cable and walk with it and slide for their hands and so they would check the brakes and make sure that everything was sort of firm and I mean the seeker is trained to lay his line to bury it at places of where there are busy crossroads and whatnot. They bury it just below and to protect the line and also if necessary try and post and have it aloft.
But so that this, but for the most part the signal, the cable would actually be on the surface.
The cable would be along the ground
and
the installation of the cable, it was a very very it was a very very strong cable. It had a sort of a red compound around it. Not rubber, in those days, compound, and they had about several strands of steel cable together with strands of copper in the cable for conductivity. Steel for strength and copper for conductivity. So the cable was really first class.
Yeah.